This is the takeaway for Thursday, November 9th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. 5 days ago, Devin Kelly walked into the First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, and murdered 26 people with an AR-15-style military rifle. As officials try to figure out why, the Air Force now admits that a lapse in protocol made it easier for Kelly to buy that gun, a gun that legally he should not have owned. On Tuesday, Defense Secretary James Mattis spoke.
First, I have to define what the problem is. If the problem is we didn't put something out, we'll correct that. There is at least an indication in what I'm reading in the press and what I'm getting from other elements of the government, not DOD, that in fact the direction is out there. But I've got to make sure. I don't want to make assumptions right now. I'll find out what's the problem.
A very careful Defense Secretary James Mattis there, while in the background, the Defense Department Inspector General investigates the Air Force. In 2012, Devin Kelly was court-martialed by the Air Force for domestic violence against his wife and stepson. Now investigators want to know how Kelly was able to walk into a San Antonio sporting goods store in 2016 and buy his AR-15, and whether someone failed to enter Kelly and his military criminal record into the FBI's criminal background check database. Here's Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson on CBS.
We're doing a full review of this case and others like it to ensure we're going through all of our databases to make sure that this wasn't the only case where this wasn't done.
Reports from as long as 20 years ago from the Pentagon Inspector General do point to the military's failure to report crimes like this to the FBI as a widespread issue. Jeffrey Corin served in the U.S. Army for 21 years and left the service as a lieutenant colonel. He's now professor of law at the South Texas College of Law in Houston. Professor Corin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Describe the lapse here as far as we know. What does it appear that the Air Force was supposed to have done in Devin Kelly's case, and what did they do instead?
Well, it appears what they are supposed to have done is to file a fingerprint card with the FBI that would be then uploaded into the National Criminal Information System. That FBI card would have indicated the offenses that Kelly had been convicted of and the sentence that had been issued, which in turn would have triggered the prohibition on selling a weapon to him if that record had been checked during the sale.
That should have meant that if Devin Kelly went into a store to buy a gun dealer or a department store, that NCIS background check would have pinged and by law, no gun.
That's what should have happened because while there's a lot of discussion about the fact that it was a crime of domestic violence, there is another disqualifying element that it fell under, which is the fact that he was convicted for an offense that has an authorized punishment of more than 1 year confinement. And the way the statute reads, there's not a requirement that he receive more than 1 year confinement. The fact that it was an authorized punishment of more than 1 year would have also disqualified him.
So that's what the Air Force should have done. What do we know about what they did?
Well, I don't think we do know, and I'm sure that the Air Force is as frustrated and probably embarrassed over this as anybody and regrets it deeply. I think what we're going to find out in the ultimate outcome of the Inspector General's investigation and if the Senate does any hearings is that the problem here is what a military commander would call a lack of unity of command or unity of effort. There are regulations and instructions in place that require this reporting. But from what I've been able to tell, the problem is there's no clear indication of who has primary responsibility for making sure it happened. So I think what we're going to find out is that this fell between the seams of different areas of responsibility between the JAG officers and the JAG office, the security police office, and perhaps even the Navy prison where Kelly was confined.
Lack of unity of command, all these different offices doing different things, and maybe nobody on the case here, Professor Corin. Do you also suspect that there may be a cultural aspect to this, that maybe the military just isn't that turned on to the idea of barring people from having guns, so this just isn't a priority?
I absolutely reject that assertion, and I've heard that periodically in some of the reporting. I just don't think it's credible. Let me give you an example. The federal statute that prohibits an individual convicted of a crime of domestic violence at the misdemeanor level indicates that anybody who's convicted of a misdemeanor of domestic violence should be in the system. The military doesn't classify offenses as misdemeanors or felonies. However, in order to maximize the probability that these reports will be submitted when appropriate, the Air Force JAG manual, the instruction on military justice, actually indicates that any conviction by any special or general court-martial involving conduct that amounts to domestic violence should be indicated on the what's called the promulgating orders or the court-martial order that is the result of the trial. And it goes so far as to put the instruction to the JAG office in terms of the type of font they should use, and it should be stamped in bold letters across the front of the order. And I think this is, you'd find this in other areas of military regulations. I don't think it's a lack of desire. I certainly don't think it's an issue of any type of malice or an effort to avoid the obligation. I really just believe it is a consequence of too many cooks in the kitchen, so to speak.
So there's been another issue, Professor Korn, that I think has been confusing to a lot of people in the aftermath here. Exactly who in the military who commits a crime or gets a sentence can be barred from purchasing guns later?
Well, the military is subject to the federal statute. So the answer is derived from the federal statute that applies to everybody else. And it would be any person who is convicted by a court-martial for any offense with a maximum penalty authorized of more than a year, which is a lot of offenses under the military code. It would be any individual who was convicted by a court-martial and received as part of the sentence a dishonorable discharge. For example, Bo Bergdahl now would be prohibited from purchasing or owning a firearm under the federal statute. And it would be any person who would fall under what's known as the Lautenberg Amendment, which is the provision of the statute that was added that says you've been convicted of a misdemeanor involving domestic violence. And again, the military appears to interpret that fairly broadly if you're convicted by a special or general court-martial.
So, Professor Korn, you spent a lot of time in the U.S. military. I know not in the Air Force. You were in the Army. Can you give me a sense of what some of the people in the command structure, given the lapse that apparently happened here and the tragedy in Texas, how they're probably feeling about this error, about what you call a failure of unity of command?
I think they're probably feeling frustrated and embarrassed to a certain extent, but most importantly, deeply concerned that what they want to be doing and what they assume has been done may not have been done consistent with what the statutory requirement is at the federal level. And I think there's going to be a very quick determination to figure out why and improve the system. If I were a betting man, I think what we're going to see probably pretty soon would be some Secretary of Defense level directive that appoints what we call an executive agent. So either at the DOD level or at the service levels, it will be a very clear statement of who has primary responsibility for making sure this data is uploaded. And another interesting piece of this is the military confinement facility level, because only the Navy and the Army run military prisons, and every service member who's convicted by a court-martial and sentenced to prison will go to one of those facilities. They're sprinkled throughout the United States and around the world. Military police regulation has a provision that requires the provision to send another fingerprint card with the sentence data to the FBI when the service member arrives at the prison and is in process. Interestingly, the Navy regulation requires the prison to take the fingerprint card, but actually says don't send it to the FBI because we assume that that's a law enforcement function. And I suspect some type of redundant reporting requirement now is going to be looked at very carefully and probably implemented.
Professor Korn, you know, if this directive does come from the Secretary of Defense or somewhere else, look, you and I both know how politicized the issue of guns is in this country. There's no doubt about it. If the military starts to revamp or crack down on how they report this information, are you worried that outside politics is going to rain down on the Pentagon about who can have a gun and who can't?
Well, look, I think there's always a risk that politics will be an element or what might call background noise when the military is trying to resolve a problem like this. We saw this a couple of years ago when the issue of concealed carry came up after the Nidal Hassan shooting at Fort Hood, and some politicians were frustrated that military commanders had regulations that prohibited service members from carrying concealed weapons on base. But I think ultimately this is a very different issue because the military has no interest in shielding or protecting service members whose misconduct is so significant that it results in a court-martial conviction and a sentence to confinement, even a short period of confinement, not to mention a sentence of a punitive discharge. So I don't think there's going to be any interest in the military of being concerned that this is unfair to service members who've been convicted by a court-martial. I think it's the exact opposite. I think in most cases, those service members, because of the conviction, are going to be on their way out of military service, and the military is going to want to make sure that it gets the data into the system so that their misconduct in the military results in the type of prohibition that Congress has imposed for everybody else.
Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Korn, Professor of Law at South Texas College of Law in Houston, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, I talked to Pete Souza, the White House photographer who took nearly 2 million photos of President Obama and his family. And you've been telling us about your favorite presidential photo.
This is Gwen calling from Auburn, Mass. My favorite picture is of Joe Biden and Barack Obama seated in a garden on white folding chairs. Joe has an arm behind Barack, his head tilted back and his eyes closed in mid-laugh. Barack is looking at him with that up-to-no-good grin.
My favorite presidential picture is the one of John John hiding, quote-unquote, under his dad's desk in the Oval Office when he was about 2.
Hi, my name's Kurt, and I'm from Austin, Texas. The one that takes the cake for me is the photo of LBJ holding up his pet beagle by the ears.
Well, Kurt, my favorite presidential photo is an iconic one, Lyndon Johnson also being sworn in on Air Force One in Dallas in November 1963, hours after President Kennedy was pronounced dead. Jackie is there beside him. You know the picture. A crowd of aides behind Johnson. Now, the best thing about this photo isn't the picture itself, but the story behind it, how Lyndon Johnson engineered that image and why Judge Sarah Hughes is the one swearing him in. Look it up. It's an incredible story. What's your favorite presidential photo? We want to know. 8778-MY-TAKE. You can call us or you can tweet us your pictures at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time. And Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. Yesterday, we told you about results in off-year elections in places like Maine and New Jersey and Virginia. Democrats had a great day and night. In Ohio, it was a little bit different because people in that state are sorting out some confusing results from a confusing ballot measure. They're still trying to figure it out. Voters in Ohio killed a measure aimed at lowering prescription drug costs in that state. It was called Issue 2, the Drug Price Relief Act, and it would have capped the price that state agencies can pay for pharmaceuticals. Well, it went down by a huge margin. 79% of voters said no. Pharmaceutical companies poured money into the state. Their own side in this fight says the drug industry's political group spent more than $50 million to defeat Issue 2. But a lot of voters in the end said they were just confused about what this measure was supposed to do, and they'd be excused for feeling whiplash leading up to Tuesday.
This ballot issue is a prescription for disaster.
Issue 2 is Ohio's chance to lower drug costs.
It could increase drug costs for millions of Ohioans.
Don't be deceived by the drug company lies. Vote yes on Issue 2.
It sounds too good to be true because it is.
Again, I said more than $50 million pouring in from drug companies, probably $20 million spent on the yes side. And you can hear the confusion in those television ads. So what was issue two all about? Why did it lose? And what does it mean for our democratic process beyond Ohio when voters maybe don't understand the ballot measure that's in front of them? Andy Chow is with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Andy, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what exactly would issue two have done? How does it work?
All right, so it would have forced state agencies, any state program that pays for prescription drugs, would have forced them to have to buy those drugs at the same discount that's afforded to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And what we know is that the VA maybe pays for 70% of the drug that everybody else pays 100% for. So it would have forced state programs to get that discount. And like you said, it was confusing because no one knew how that would have actually worked, how you actually enforce something like that, and what the repercussions could be.
All right. The VA gets big discounts because they have a giant health system there. They can negotiate lower drug prices, and they do. You know, Andy, on the face of it, it seems like a no-brainer, right? Voters by pretty wide margins always say they support controlling drug prices and using the government to do it. So what explains the lopsided result against it here?
Well, I think there are a couple of things here. One is this issue has been around for about 2 years now in the state because of the way the process works to even getting on the ballot. So, I mean, if you would have asked people right away what they thought about this ballot issue, they probably would have said, hey, lower drug costs, that sounds good to me. But because it was here percolating for so long and there was so much information that people could pull out of it, they learned more about it, and it really gave the drug companies a longer time to spin it too. So the drug companies had a year or the past 6 months for sure to really pump a lot of money into it, to put so many ads out there. You heard the ones that said it'll raise costs for 2/3 of Ohioans. They've been saying that for the past 6 months on TV ads.
Well, let's get a taste of some of that confusion. Here's Christine, who called us from Ohio.
I consider myself an informed voter, but I could not figure out who and what to believe on issue two in Ohio. So I voted no. My name is Christine, and I live outside of Akron, Ohio.
Andy, there's one voter who listens to you, I hope, in Ohio, who said she was just confused by the whole thing. But this isn't the first time around the block for a policy like this. Voters in California killed a similar measure last year. So what do we actually know? Is there good information on whether the law actually would have lowered drug costs?
There's no way of knowing right now. I think that's kind of where we got down to, because, I mean, we as journalists have been following this issue for a while now, and no one could really get down to the nitty-gritty to find out, is this actually going to work? We actually, at the state of Ohio, have a process where if something on the bill is going to affect the budget in any way, then the Office of Budget and Management does their own independent research. So not the people who are telling you to vote yes, not the people who are telling you to vote no, but Ohio's independent researcher. They looked into it and they said, we don't know. We have no idea. We can't tell you if this is going to save the state $400 million or if it's going to result in increased drug prices for other people. Because keep in mind, the big issue here, the big argument is that, yes, this might cap drug prices and give a discount for people who are on Medicaid or getting drugs from workers' comp. But we don't know what's going to happen to the 2/3 of the other Ohioans who are on private insurance plans, because they say if the drug companies have to give a discount to the state programs, then they're just going to raise the prices for the private insurers.
Let's hear from another listener here from Athens, Ohio, who voted no on issue two, not because of confusion, but because they just didn't like the policy.
My town has a large mental health facility. I have several friends that are employed as doctors and nurses there, and they informed me that if issue two would have passed, it would have politicized medications that healthcare professionals are able to prescribe for patients. Doctors and other healthcare professionals should have the freedom and the ability to prescribe medications that their patients need.
Lots of doctor groups and medical groups came out against issue two as well.
Yeah, all the major groups. I mean, there were about 80 organizations and associations that came out against it. All the ones that really people have grown to trust here in Ohio. I think one of the big ones is the Veteran Services, the group that advocates for veteran affairs, came out against it. So there are ads that say a vote yes would hurt veterans, doctors associations, nurses, they all came out against it. And that was kind of the big slam against this issue. Like, it came from California. And then when it came here, people, critics were saying that the sponsor of the Drug Price Relief Act, Michael Weinstein, who founded the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, they say that Weinstein never made an effort to try to reach out to Ohio groups to find out how this plan can best suit Ohio and kind of change it and revamp it in a way for it to be customized for Ohio needs. And I think that really hurt a lot of its chances of winning over support from all those groups that came out against it in the end.
Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio. Thanks, Andy.
Yeah, thanks.
Hello, my name is Rand Dipple. I'm calling from Oroville, Ohio, and I voted no because anytime you limit a company's ability to charge for a product with one group, the other groups will have to make up the difference.
Hi, my name is Daniel Dudley. I'm calling from Cleveland, Ohio. I voted for issue 2 after going back and forth with myself many times. I work in the healthcare industry, and even with that background, day in and day out, I still felt that I did not understand the issue enough to make a truly informed decision, so I had to go with my gut.
We are still hearing from bewildered Ohio voters on issue 2. Whatever your issue is, get in touch with us. We're at 8778-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, we just talked about that ballot initiative in Ohio where voters rejected the idea of lower drug prices through state law. Healthcare was also on the ballot in Maine on Election Day, and by a nearly 20-point margin, Mainers voted yes to expand Medicaid. This makes Maine the first state to expand Medicaid with a ballot initiative. State lawmakers in Maine have tried to expand Medicaid under the ACA before, 6 times, in fact, only to face a veto by Republican Governor Paul LePage every single time. But after Tuesday's yes vote, Governor LePage is still not backing down. He threatened not to enforce the expansion, even though it would bring health coverage to an estimated 80,000 people in Maine. Sarah Gideon is the Speaker of the Maine House of Representatives. She represents Maine's 48th District, and she's been part of a bipartisan push to expand Medicaid in her state. Madam Speaker, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You got a pretty big victory at the ballot box here. Close to 60% of Mainers want to expand Medicaid.
That's right. It was a really significant day and a day for celebration for many Mainers, because what people said at the ballot box is, we want access to healthcare. Not only do we want it for ourselves, but we want to make sure that our fellow Mainers have it also.
So Mainers voted for this, Madam Speaker, but this fight doesn't appear to be over. The governor, as I mentioned, says he won't implement this policy unless you and the legislature find a way to pay for it. And right now, your state budgeters say that means $54 million from the state. You get another $500 million from Washington. How are you going to do this?
This is really a battle that we have been fighting for years since Medicaid expansion became available for states. What the governor basically is saying is, I'm going to obstruct this at every turn. Now, by saying that we have to fund it, well, of course we have to fund it. And that will always be a bipartisan exercise. The way we look at things right now as we head into 2018 is that sometime towards the latter part of the year, we will need to have funding in place for that. Before we even get to that point, the governor and his administration need to start the implementation process, and we are going to make sure that they do, whether it's by legislative action or from people outside the legislature.
Aren't there enough Republicans in the Senate and in your legislature to block that funding? I mean, essentially giving Paul LePage the excuse that he needs to stand in your way here?
Well, I think that's what we're going to have to determine. And, you know, what's a little bit different, obviously, I guess, about this circumstance is that this time it was passed at the ballot box with a very clear, significant majority of people saying they want to do it. But the other significant thing here is that it is primarily people who live in rural areas who tend to be the uninsured people who will actually benefit under main care. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is that these are people who tend to be represented by the very Republicans who have voted against Medicaid in the past. And what we hope is that they will end up really impacting how Republicans vote on this in terms of funding in an election year.
So, Speaker Gideon, where do you think then your political leverage will be if this winds up in a fight with the governor and it goes back to the legislature? Is the pressure on Republican lawmakers to free up the money, or do you think at long last Paul LePage is going to bow to public pressure in a way that he never has before?
Realistically, I think that Paul LePage will go as far as he can with this to not have Medicaid expansion happen while he is governor. That being said, I think it will really be up to the legislature and Republicans in the legislature and people who have bowed to his pressure to instead listen to what their constituents have said and bow to the pressure of what is right for Maine people.
Maine votes to expand Medicaid, but the fight is far from over. Sarah Gideon, Speaker of the House in Maine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Oklahoma now, where an alternative to incarceration is raising red flags about how offenders are treated and who profits. Christian Alcoholics and Addicts in Recovery, or CARE, it's one of a handful of programs in Oklahoma that claims to give addicts work experience and addiction treatment instead of time behind bars. But the Oklahoma ACLU says that these organizations are really unpaid labor camps, and some participants agree.
And you find out real quick, you're going to go to work, you're going to work hard, you're going to work hard for at least 40 hours, you know, 40 hours a week for the rest of the year you're here.
That was Aaron Snyder, a former CARE participant. Snyder was interviewed by Reveal reporters Amy Julia Harris and Shoshana Walter. According to Harris, many of the men who entered the uncertified CARE program didn't get what they agreed to with a judge.
We talked to a lot of people who went to the program saying that they were expecting it to be a rehab facility where they were going to get addiction help and treatment. But when they get there, they found out very quickly that it is mainly a work camp. And every day is spent working at chicken processing plants owned by Simmons Foods, which is a major poultry company that makes chicken that goes to Walmart, KFC, and Popeyes. And men in the program work full-time slaughtering and gutting chickens for free. Chicken processing plants have some of the highest rates of injury of any workplaces in the country. And men were getting grueling injuries in the CARE program where their hands were getting gnarled from hanging chickens along a line for hours and hours each day. Many men in the program got their hands caught in machines. They were maimed on the job. And hanging over their head in all of this was the threat of prison because they were sent there from diversion courts, where their stay at the rehab center was in lieu of incarceration. So if they were not working, they couldn't stay in the program and could risk being incarcerated.
I mean, has anybody at the program said to these men that are there, hey, all of this work for free is part of your recovery?
Yeah, what they say is that the work pays for the recovery program. So the idea of the program is that it was a self-supporting, quote-unquote, free program where people would be sent there by the criminal justice system and would have to work in order to pay for food, lodging, and occasional meetings with counselors and AA meetings and support groups.
I mean, the idea of working for free when you're in the criminal justice program isn't a new one. We've heard those old tropes about being in prison and making license plates or breaking rocks. For the state, ostensibly for the taxpayer, for the public interest, repaying your debt to society. This is a private company, though, benefiting directly from the labor of these men who are trying to avoid prison.
Yeah, it's a little different than prison programs as well, because many of the men who are sent to this program have not yet been convicted of crimes. These are pre-conviction diversion programs where people were supposed to be getting rehab and treatment help for really serious addictions, heroin addictions, opiate addictions, meth addictions. And the CARE program is interesting also because it had its ties from the very beginning went to chicken company executives. CARE was started started in 2007 by executives from Simmons Foods who were having trouble filling their overnight shifts at the chicken processing plants. And they also wanted to help alcoholics and addicts. So they came up with this idea of a rehab program that would be self-supporting, where men from the criminal justice system would work for free in the chicken plants, and all of their paychecks would go to the rehab program to provide food and other services.
What have the people at Simmons said in response to your reporting and in response to several of the lawsuits that have been filed against them?
They said that they partnered with the CARE program because they wanted to give alcoholics and addicts a chance. They said that they do not rely on the program, that basically they are providing a benefit to the community by employing these men.
And the state of Oklahoma, what do they say about this arrangement?
Tulsa's drug court, which sends the vast majority of people to the CARE program, said that they have stopped sending defendants to the program as they do their own internal investigation. And different lawmakers and people at various levels of government have launched their own investigations looking into the program.
Amy Julia Harris, reporter with Reveal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today. It's Todd Zwillick. Earlier this year, reporter Ryan Gabrielson was snowbound in Wisconsin, holed up in his hotel room skimming the news. He covers courts for ProPublica, and one story he was skimming jumped out.
One of them popped up from the New York Times about a 2002-2003 case Justice Kennedy wrote about sex offenders. And in it, he said that sex offenders who don't get treatment have a startlingly high rate of recidivism, upwards of around 80%.
A disturbing stat, but turns out that statistic was false. It was something Justice Kennedy referenced from a Psychology Today article written by a guy who says he didn't have any research to support that number, but just figured it to be true. In other words, the Supreme Court delivered an opinion setting legal precedent for years to come using made-up facts.
They've just got it wrong.
And that made Ryan start to wonder,
has this ever happened before? Do they not vet what they put in their majority opinions?
That question sent Ryan Gabrielson down a Supreme Court rabbit hole.
We decided to just expand it out, take a look at what ultimately became 83 cases, and we found seven things and seven opinions that were just demonstrably false or completely baseless.
So give us a sense of some of the false facts or errors or just bad information that you found here.
Part of the fun of this was it was a wide spectrum of things that got messed up on all kinds of different subjects involving all kinds of, you know, different justices. You know, the most egregious was probably the error in, it was a case called NASA v. Nelson. A bunch of scientists at the Jet Propulsion Lab had sued because they didn't want to be subjected to government background checks. Their case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they lost, in part, in an opinion written by Justice Alito, saying, look, these kinds of things that are being challenged here are part of standard background checks that are done by 88% of private American companies. That was based on a court document filed by an outside party, who's somebody who's not part of a legal case before the court, but has a special interest or a special expertise. And in the background check industry groups put together a brief that in that there was a statistic about the 88%. The brief that was filed from the industry groups didn't cite a source. And when I went to ask them, so where's this from? Because when I was doing my own checks, I couldn't independently verify this 88% number. They initially pointed me to a source that I already checked and that didn't match it. And they gave me a whole host of different explanations for, you know, different ways to cut the numbers, to look at them one way or the other. They got a preliminary version of it, all of which proved false. The industry groups now say, we're not entirely sure where that came from.
Ryan, is this intentional misleading, though, or inadvertent falsehoods? Maybe just simple motivated reasoning, right? Lawyers want to make the most persuasive argument. Even somebody in an amicus brief for one side or the other wants to make a persuasive argument, and they say, yep, that fits what I want to say.
I'd say there are instances in what we found in the seven errors. There are examples of all of the above. But there is no question willful, at times, deceit on the part of people who are filing. The Solicitor General has been caught twice in the past 15 years providing the court information that was, one case that it absolutely knew was false. And in another case, the data had been analyzed 6 different ways incorrectly, all of which just so happened to help the government's case.
So is there any fact-checking at the Supreme Court? There are no Supreme Court investigators. Can someone just say anything under oath in a brief as long as they believe it to be true?
Well, there are state bar associations and certainly the D.C. bar have rules for lawyers who are submitting the briefs about truthfulness, and you can't intentionally deceive the courts. With that said, you know, justices, is there a formal fact-checking process? There is not. You know, each justice has a staff of clerks who are arguably the best and brightest that our country's law schools have to offer. But as smart as they are, they're not trained as fact-checkers. They're not trained as investigators or researchers. They are lawyers. They don't know how to do this kind of work. And the justices are very much the same thing.
So, Ryan, we all make mistakes. I don't want to say that journalists intentionally stretch the truth ever. But we have a corrections process in our business. If we get something wrong, we correct it on the air. People correct it in print over at our colleagues at newspapers. Do Supreme Court justices or the lawyers that argue before them get a chance to make a correction when they get it wrong?
They absolutely get a chance, and they do. Increasingly, they do it in a more transparent way because they've been called to the carpet on this. There was a law professor at Harvard, Richard Lazarus, who wrote a really excellent, expansive piece examining how the Supreme Court corrects its errors and how sort of opaque that process has historically been. And so the court in recent years has started posting those corrections, you know, the content of them and not so much necessarily why, but just to fix factual errors. And you can look those up on their website now. But that's a fairly recent change. And what they definitely have not done is reconsider opinions or their rulings in cases where the factual errors at least were cited as central to the argument they're making.
And that raises one of the final questions here, Ryan, which is, so how important are these errors in the end?
That's really hard to know. The majority of the 83 cases that I examined did not have a single assertion, a statement about how the real world works. Only 24 of the 83 did. But when they are used, they are generally central to the argument. Even if they're doing it after the fact, where they're trying to justify the decision they've come to separately, these errors can have really broad ramifications in shaping public opinion about how things work. The sex offender statistic was cited over and over again, and it became sort of a de facto, generally accepted truth that sex offenders were sort of perpetual threats out in the world. And that, you know, that was really based on nothing. But a Supreme Court, you know, majority opinion echoes down for decades, centuries in some cases.
Ryan Gabrielson is a reporter for ProPublica covering the U.S. justice system. Hey, Ryan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Everybody, please have a seat.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. You know, White House photographer Pete Souza did not have to compete with all of those news photographers you're listening to there to get his shots when he was around President Obama. Pete Souza took nearly 2 million photos of the president and his family over the years. Since leaving the White House in January, Souza's Instagram and Twitter feeds have earned him millions of followers. And a big part of that is Pete Souza's habit of posting photos of President Obama timed just for a moment to draw a contrast with the current president, President Donald Trump. For example, in July, after President Trump bragged about winning the election in front of a Boy Scout jamboree, Souza posted a picture of a young African-American Cub Scout in awe meeting President Obama. Souza captioned that photo saying President Obama did not discuss his electoral wins with the young boy. And so some people call Pete Souza a very talented troll. But he disagrees. Anyway, when Pete Souza got the job as chief White House photographer, he had to convince that very White House to give him unprecedented access.
It was not totally given to me. I had to earn his trust, and I had to push for access to make sure that I was able to create this photographic archive.
Part of that archive can be seen in Pete Souza's new book. It's called Obama, An Intimate Portrait. It comes out this week. I talked to Pete Souza about how his work was used in the real world of politics to construct a presidential image that benefits the president, and also what it takes to keep a fresh eye on a president that you see every day.
It's absolutely a challenge. I mean, this is a 24/7 job that you're essentially have one main subject, you know, every day for 8 years. I mean, I saw him in his role as husband and father and on vacation, playful modes. But I was always aware that he still was the president of the United States.
You know, the familiarity that you would have with your subject leads to an intimacy that I think many people have seen in your photos and an ability to capture the president's personality and his worldview in your images. Then again, with too much familiarity, it's possible to become a little bit numb.
I guess so. I mean, I try to not necessarily think, oh, I've got to photograph this moment because this is a historical moment. I was trying to photograph every moment. One of the things I try to do in my book is not only tell the narrative of his 8 years in the White House, but also show some really cool pictures that I like. And maybe they're not revealing about him, but hopefully they're revealing about what the presidency as a whole is.
You know, you mentioned your Instagram feed and how you post things online. And you've been pretty intentional about when and where you post certain photos of the Obamas, Pete Souza. You've gained a reputation recently as a very subtle and effective commentator through your photos. By contrast, I mean, there was an example recently when President Trump went after MSNBC host Mika Brzezinski after she criticized him. You posted a series of photos of President Obama with the caption, "Respect for Women," where he's in a lot of different situations, listening closely to women. And you meant to draw a contrast here.
Is that when that happened? I can't really recall. I think my Instagram feed speaks for itself. I honestly think that I'm pretty respectful and playful and subtle. And, you know, especially when you compare it to what some people tweet, for instance.
Well, Pete, you know what I'm getting at, which is in the age of Instagram and Twitter, you have earned a reputation as one of the internet's deftest and subtlest trolls. And I don't mean troll in a disparaging way, but one who uses the medium to draw contrasts and maybe undermine somebody in a very, very gentle way.
You're absolutely free to draw that conclusion if you will.
But it's not something you've ever intended.
I think people that look at my Instagram feed can take it for what it's worth. And there's no need for me to go beyond saying what I'm posting on Instagram. That says it all for me. I don't need to say anything about it.
I've always wanted to ask you about being an artist and a photographer in the context of politics in the White House. I mean, you have so many photos that have become iconic of President Obama and the First Family. The young African-American child touching the president's hair is one example. The Spider-Man kid stopping a villain Obama dead in his tracks. Everybody has seen this photo. The president and the first lady embracing each other at a rally. I think it became, in 2012, when you took that photo, the most retweeted picture in the history of Twitter up until then. As enjoyable as these photos are, I mean, they are to a purpose that's not necessarily art. They've been instrumental in helping the White House craft an image of the president and the first lady that's advantageous to them. And there's really no way around this in politics. It's part of the game. How have you approached that inevitable dynamic?
I think you're, you know, drawing conclusions maybe based on a false premise. You know, my job was to create authentic photographs and capture moments that include moods, emotions that truly happen. People can draw conclusions however they want.
Is it a different set of rules for someone like you photographing a president than some other kind of photographer photographing someone who doesn't have as much stake in public opinion or public perception?
You're asking me to weigh into interpretation that should not be up to me. It should be up to you. And you essentially, I guess, have already made your own interpretation and conclusion about what these photographs mean, which is fine. That's the whole point of photography, is every person is different. And all I can do is present the best photographs of this president during his 8 years. The challenge that I had in putting a book together is you can't do a book with 1.9 million photographs. you can't do a 2,000-page book. So you do a 350-page book, and you try to, in those 352 pages, put together a series of photos that demonstrate what President Obama was like as a person, what he was like as president, and what the scenes around the White House were like during my tenure there.
I got a question for you, Pete, before we let you go. I know you've been asked before, but I've always been dying to know. What's one moment that you missed that maybe you still think about, that you didn't get to the shutter fast enough?
I'm sure that there were situations that I never even saw because I wasn't in the room that I missed. But hopefully, I didn't miss anything crucial when I was in the room. I mean, that was sort of my goal, and probably what makes this job so difficult is you talked about these, iconic moments. But a lot of my job is kind of like watching paint dry, right? You're hanging around, and because you don't know that Spider-Man's going to come in and try to zap you in its web. But you got to be ready for those moments.
1.9 million presidential photographs boil down to, just about 350 or so in the new book, Obama, An Intimate Portrait, from White House photographer Pete Souza. Pete, thanks for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
My name is Michael Hawkins, and I'm calling from Chicago, Illinois. Any photo taken in the Oval Office is a favorite of mine. As a black male born in Natchez, Mississippi in the 60s, I knew that we would have a black president one day. I didn't know that I'd be allowed to see it happen. I recently escorted him as part of a security team, and as he exited the elevator, he thanked me. I squeezed his hand a little tighter than he did mine and said, "No, thank you, sir."
Keep telling us about your favorite presidential photos, 8778MyTake. You can always head to our Facebook page. And some of Pete Souza's photos are on our website. Check that out, too. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, providing legal answers to the day-to-day questions of small business owners through its network of independent attorneys, available nationwide. More information at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.